Jill.
Hello, Aaron. I'm great. How are you doing? Hot minute.
Been a little busy. We got things things cooking hot. It's on the hot burner. And and we have Michael Shulman today. That is with a C in the last name, as I learned. Google is not always your friend. But Michael, thrilled to have you. I've read your book, and we're going to unpack it a little bit. So welcome.
Yeah, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Awesome.
And Michael, I know you're a writer at The New Yorker. You've written a couple books. The most recent was Oscar Wars. I believe that was... Is that earlier last year when it was released? Okay. And I know you've also written about Meryl Streep, which is interesting parallel. We might explore that a little bit, but and meet Jill. She is our co-host and co-owner of Cine Journeys. And we've been delving into award season. Now, Jill, I think I've spoken for you before, but award season's not really your thing, right?
So I love Oscar history, especially the golden age of Hollywood Oscar history. But I've just in the last 10, 15 years have really soured on the whole experiment. I also... You know, that coincides with having a kid. So that means that I don't see as many new films as I would like to in the theater, mainly because now this is pre-streaming, I guess I should say. So, you know, by the time you factor in a babysitter and the tickets, and then people are on their phones during the movie, you know, you're looking at $250 to be really pissed off. So I, for many years, it's been very difficult for me to catch up with the new films. So I usually have no interest in what's going on. Now, that has changed somewhat with movies making it to streaming or coming out, you know, on streaming almost immediately upon release, which is a whole nother topic for a different episode, I guess. But I am a little more familiar with what is being nominated, but I still just really don't care about the whole process.
I love your honesty.
So award season, you know, we're in the middle of the award season journey right now that Aaron and Mark Herney are leading. And I basically said to Aaron, you know, I'm going to peace out. So I was like, look, y'all have fun. I'll pop in as it makes sense where I'm interested. And this is one of those times that I'm very interested is having Michael on the podcast to discuss the lovely history behind the awards.
And Michael, I want to say a few things about Oscar Wars, but before that, is there anything else that we, that listeners, viewers might be interested in you, anything you've done or anything you're into, any, your taste, that sort of thing?
Stuff that I'm into?
Well, cinematically,
I'm just stuff you're into. Cinema.
That's what we care about, yeah. You can be into cats, that's fine. Our listeners are
into cats. I'm into my cat. My cat's name is Natasha. I'm not sure
that
where she's hiding right now.
Is an amazing name for a cat.
Yeah.
Well, we bought her in Brighton Beach from this Russian lady, so she needed a proper Russian name. What I write books about, like Meryl Love Streep, it. The Oscars, show business.
Show business, like yeah. Well, that's cool. Again, thrilled to have you. And I read Oscar Wars. It was actually kind of prep for this. But the thing is, you know, Jill and I are, you know, fairly fluent on cinema history. I would say maybe we're underselling ourselves. I mean, like we've studied it and all that. Went to school, you know, written plenty. But I thought the book was... Well, so that's the thing with being a cinephile. Yeah, that's what we are, is that we hear a lot of these stories. I know all about The Blacklist. I know all about, you know, the Best Actress campaign from 1950. And we all have our opinions there. I'm Team Swanson. I'm sorry, Jill. But
Jill,
so,
what are you?
Team Judy.
Team Judy.
Oh, really?
I love Gloria, but Judy is sublime.
Judy Holliday and Born Yesterday. She did win, and I think it's a justified win. But I'm Team Bette Davis, All About Eve. I mean, that's just my favorite.
I mean, it's an impossible.
One of my favorites ever.
It's an impossible.
It's impossible. It was an impossible situation.
It's a three-way Sophie's choice.
I think it's so. I would have loved, you know, any of those are wonderful. I guess when I say I'm Team Judy is because people say she didn't deserve it, and I'm like, yeah, she did.
She did. Yeah.
But
I
the
agree.
Stories, the stories in your book, even though this was film history I was aware of, obviously I knew that Judy won that, and that Betty and Gloria and others, and I forget who was the fifth one, you probably remember, that was nominated.
Yeah, Eleanor Parker for Caged. Yes.
That's right. Yeah,
which is also fantastic.
Not seen Caged.
Fantastic, but man, was she not going to win that?
No.
Yeah, boy, tough competition. But the stories, like, I had no idea about the whole Zanuck thing, and you know, the animosity. Now, I'm not surprised because, you know, Bette Davis had a reputation as being kind of cantankerous. But the thing is, all these stories, even through The Blacklist and, you know, even Moonlight and La La Land, you know, even that, I was watching and hearing the suspense. But you brought a lot of, you know, color to these stories. You brought a lot of supplemental materials. And and sometimes even when we knew it, like, unfortunately, we lived through the Weinstein Miramax thing. And that was sometimes difficult to listen to, but still really, really well written. In fact, we mentioned to one of our subscribers to award season that we were having you, and he's already picked up your book, and he said it's amazing. And I think he said it's breezy is the word he used.
I like that. I like breezy, especially because the book is a little long. You know, it covers 100 years of history, so I like that people feel like they're breezing on through it. I wanted to make it, you know, really, obviously I did a ton of research and wanted to make it, you know, meaningful, but also I wanted to make it fun. And I wanted to acknowledge that the Oscars are in many ways completely ridiculous and absurd and frivolous. And that's part of what's funny about, like, so that's part of what's great about them, I think, is that it's sort of this meaningless talisman that you can see people tripping over themselves to win. To attain, it's like this holy grail. And to me, what's fascinating is the behavior that it brings out in people and the conflict that it creates with people and in Hollywood, and the way that it reveals changes in tastes and changes in culture and changes in the movie business.
Yes.
It's also like a big farce, you know? I was thinking about that when I was working on the chapter on Best Picture 1976, which has one of them is Robert Altman's Nashville. And I feel like the Oscars are kind of like that movie. Like they're this big, crazy, overpopulated, like farce.
Mm-hmm. I loved how you covered that too, because Nashville, honestly, is one of those movies that, like, I love, and I love Altman, and it's like, how in the world did that get nominated? It was really groundbreaking, and you even got into stuff, again, stuff I had, you know, I've read the comment or watched the commentary on the disc, but, like, you know, how he recorded the dialogue, you know, I'd kind of forgotten about that, and it's really innovative. But of course, that's never going to be Best Picture, especially when you have, like, The Greatest Show on Earth, which I've never seen. And I know that's, like, the one that's keeping me from being complete, because I understand it's not so great.
No, see, this is what I love about the Oscars, is that that movie won. Mm-hmm. And it's just a shit show. Yeah. It's a total shit show.
See, but this is a great example of what I find fascinating about the Oscars and how I wanted to approach them. The Greatest Show on Earth, this was 1954, I believe, the Oscars that year. You know, it's this big, dumb Cecil B. DeMille circus spectacular, clearly part of Hollywood's effort to try to compete with television by just being bigger and more lavish and more colorful and more stunts. And it's basically the best, you know, it's basically like a substitute for actually going to the circus for people who didn't go. Mm-hmm. And this new idea of cinema as like extravaganza. And, you know, it won, and it's considered one of the worst Best Picture winners ever. And that in itself, you could look at it and say, well, you know, as I say in the first line of the book, the Oscars are always getting it wrong, which is true. But what's fascinating when I looked closer at that year is that the movie that I think should have won is High Noon. Why didn't High Noon win?
Yeah.
Because High Noon was written by Carl Foreman, a blacklisted screenwriter. And High Noon is in itself actually a sort of allegory for the blacklist and for the cowardice of people he knew in Hollywood who were suddenly shrinking away from anyone who was in trouble. While Cecil B. DeMille was this arch conservative and, of course, a veteran in the industry by that point. And then at the same time, Singing in the Rain didn't even get nominated, which is a Shonda, as we say. And, you know, and looking, so looking at the High Noon, why did High Noon not get, you know, get beat by this dumb circus movie? Well, it's actually because in large part of the blacklist and what was going on in the subtext of that race. You know, I even saw evidence that, you know, people on the Academy board were trying to sabotage High Noon's Best Picture race. And no one even wanted to accept Carl Foreman's screenwriting Oscar should he win it on his behalf.
And see, this is exactly when I get so tickled when today that people will say, well, the Oscars are so political. It's been, everything's been, Hollywood has been politicized. And I go, all right, well.
Things were a little different back in the day.
I mean, it's been this way forever. It's never not been political. It has always been political, the whole process. So
it's a lobbying effort.
Well, it may have not been as overt, but it was still happening. And that is the perfect example of that. There was no way they were going to let High Noon win. No way.
And one thing I've forgotten to mention, in fact, I don't think our subscribers or listeners or anybody knows this yet, but I chose to give away Bridge Over the River Kwai because for award season, because that's an iconic film, which you wrote about. And it has this Oscar winner who does not speak English, as I understand, or at least was not fluent in English, and wrote the novel in French, but because they had really two screenwriters, and I know those credits were complicated, and I would recommend read your book for that story. It's a fascinating story about who did what and who got credited, but it is really an amazing film because the film stood on itself, and I think it was a stepping stone to, you know, eroding the blacklist. I'm going to have an article coming out soon about Kazan, which is, you know, he took the opposite side and named names, of course, as everybody knows, but was stubborn and obstinate. And, you know, that showed up in his filmmaking. So, the blacklist is a scar, but I thought you covered it very, very well.
Thanks. I mean, with something like the blacklist, it's sort of like, you know, books and books have been written about the blacklist. And how do I tell a story about it that you haven't heard before? And what I chose to do is just take these three screenwriters who wrote Oscar-winning screenplays while on the blacklist and talk about their lives and their sort of intertwining journeys and how they used the Oscars as a kind of weapon against the blacklist, especially Dalton Trumbo.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Bridge on the River Kwai is such an amazing little story because, as you said, like it was written by two people on the blacklist. One of them was Carl Foreman, who we already mentioned because he wrote High Noon. The other was Michael Wilson, who went on to write, co-write Lawrence of Arabia and Planet of the Apes. I mean, he had already won an Oscar as well. He was, you know, exiled in France at the time. They didn't collaborate on the script. One was fired and replaced by the other, basically. But it was their script. They couldn't get the credit because they were on the blacklist. And so the movie credited to the French novelist, Pierre Boulle, who had written the novel. And when he won, you know, it was a farce. Again, it was like a travesty, and everybody knew it. And everybody knew that Carl Foreman and Michael Wilson had written Bridge Over the River Kwai, but couldn't acknowledge it. And so the writers figured out how to exploit that tension. And it's, I found it to be, in a way, you know, The Blacklist is very dark and very sad, of course, but in a way I found that the Oscar story about these three writers was funny in certain ways, because mm-hmm. they were using their wits and their cleverness and yep. writing these great movies and then winning Oscars for them that they couldn't show up to accept, right. and kind of playing the press.
Yeah,
and some
absolutely.
Of the best films of the day. I mean, those three people you mentioned, including Trumbo, of course, who I think Trumbo might have been the greatest living writer during his time, were marvels. So, well, okay,
but yeah,
switch gears.
You're totally correct about that. Is the whole thing is a farce, and how just they all know it's happening. So why don't you just speak it? Like it's insane.
It was open secret,
but they couldn't admit it.
It really is such a dark side, a very dark
and baffling part of our history.
But I'm going to switch gears a little bit. There have been some controversies, but I think the consensus is it's been a very good year for film. So I'd like to ask your opinion on that. And also, I'd just like to ask, you know, how closely you follow the Oscars. Like, do you get possessed like I do and want to watch every single nomination, even the ones that don't get any? Like, May December got one, but say All of Us Strangers.
Oh, yeah. I follow it very closely, and I write about it for The New Yorker, and I go to the Oscars and write about them from sitting in the balcony. But I try to watch all of the movies that are nominated, at least for major categories. And of course I get wrapped up in it. And I have my own, you know, my own faves. Unfortunately, one of them was May December, which got completely shafted with one screenplay nomination.
Yeah.
But, you know, I love Todd Haynes. Todd Haynes has never been nominated for Best Directing. Todd Haynes just, you know, he just... You know, Carol was nominated for Best Picture. It's just incredible how the Academy just freezes out Todd Haynes. And, you know, the day the nominations came out, everyone was up in arms about Greta Gerwig and Margot Robbie. And I was just thinking, Todd Haynes must be avenged.
Hey, he's in wonderful company, though. So many fantastic filmmakers, actors. Yeah. Well, you know this. Yeah, they don't get it. They don't get the recognition.
And one of the approaches we've tried to take is like try to figure out which films from now will stand the test of time. And, you know, it's kind of like High Noon. You know, High Noon was on a couple of film studies syllabuses I took, and The Greatest Show on Earth was not. So aside from May December,
that would be my goal. Is I'm going to teach a class, and The Greatest Show on Earth is going to be on that syllabus.
Circus cinema.
Yeah, Billy Rose's Jumbo, The Greatest Show on Earth.
But High Noon cut to the clock. I mean, it's, you know, it's plain as day. It's actually a great, great student film. I have a Native American wife, so I, you know, had a different perspective. And I thought you made a good argument in your Barbie article, speaking of which, I am Knuff, which I get that is not the point of Barbie, but I like the shirt. So,
I guess
Lily Gladstone, hooray.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. And the idea that people are bemoaning, you know, Margot Robbie not getting nominated for Best Actress when we have a historic Best Actress nomination for Lily Gladstone. It's gotten a little bit out of control, the outrage and the discourse.
It's insane.
Robbie was great.
She is fantastic. And I really did enjoy Barbie. I thought it was a fun movie. I think, you know, it probably thinks it's more important than it is, but that's okay. I would have been fine with her getting nominated, but I'm fine with her not being nominated. And she's been nominated as a producer, which is
for
Best Picture, and a writer. So,
and she she could win for, yeah.
Right.
So, Gerwig, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Right, Greta. So I think those are perfectly great categories mm-hmm. to be nominated in. Should Greta have been nominated for Best Director? I would argue that more than Robbie's omission here. Mm-hmm. But, I think the outrage is so stupid. I don't really understand, that's the exact point of the movie.
Right.
You know, it's being carried out. Oh my God. I can't believe this. I just think it's people need to, as we say to people on the internet, they need to go outside and touch grass just a little bit, just a little right. bit.
Well, you know, when I saw that there were these, this sort of mixed result for Barbie, having right. researched this book, where my mind went was immediately not to where everyone else's minds went, maybe, but I immediately thought of Jaws in 1976, mm-hmm. because that was another huge blockbuster, a summer blockbuster, a crowd pleaser, you know, a cultural phenomenon in so many ways. And famously, it was nominated for Best Picture, but the young director, Steven Spielberg, was snubbed in his category. And he was the only director that year who didn't match the categories, who, you know, the only director of a Best Picture nomination who wasn't nominated for directing. And I think that what I argued in my piece is that the Academy has always had this sort of conflicted
yeah.
sense of what to do with huge, you know, commercial blockbusters. And I think that is, and also comedies. Comedy is always yes. underrepresented.
Definitely.
And so there's certainly a, you know, an important conversation about the gender barrier in the directing category. But to me, the fact that mm-hmm. it was both of those together, best actress and best director, made me think that there was something else going on with yeah. Barbie, yeah. a kind of ambivalence about how to reward it, even though these are two separate branches voting on
right.
acting right. versus directing. I mean, clearly Margot Robbie's snub in Best Actress was not about sexism, because it's an all-female category. So like, what is it? Why were mm-hmm. these two major people who, you know, for the major achievements of the movie, the ones that didn't get in, while it went on and got six other nominations,
including yeah. America Ferrera, which no one right, seems right, to be right. talking about at all.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I think she had
she had
a showier part in a way, like her and Ryan Gosling, they had like these scene stealing moments that just,
yes.
you know, chew the scenery, and, you know, they had people in their pockets. And I think a role like Margot Robbie's doesn't necessarily get you over the edge when
right.
While a supporting, all those supporting nomination needs is one great scene, and they each had one great mm-hmm. scene.
That's right.
Like Judd That's Hirsch right. and the Fablemans last year, you know.
Exactly.
Yep.
It's yeah, it's just like a different calculation than Best Actor and Best Actress.
And America had, I mean, she had that mm-hmm. speech, that take one deep breath, rattle it all out speech that every, right. you know, when I saw this in the theater, you know, I can't really cry anymore because of all the antidepressants, but that, that speech, as corny and as, you know, it kind of got me, and I had like a little tear come out of the corner because mm-hmm. it was true.
It was great. Yeah.
At, you know, and so that's what got her that nomination. And as far as Ryan Gosling, I mean, the whole, you know, I'm just Ken, MGM musical mm-hmm. montage of that did it for him. So I, but that's kind of what's been irritating me about this whole thing is, yes, we need to be talking about Lily, but also mm-hmm. you did have this great performance from America Ferrera that is getting recognized. And, you know, Margot Robbie's great. I think she's fantastic in this, but I also didn't feel like it felt like a natural extension of her personality. So it didn't really feel, and this is a testament maybe to her acting, but it just didn't feel outstanding, I guess.
Yeah, it's kind of a discredit to the others, like Sandra Hüller. She got nominated, and the Academy doesn't list who was one or five. I mean, I think Lily was probably one. But Benning got a lot of hate because of Naiad, and I agree that Naiad was not the best movie. It's not as good of a movie as Barbie or Killers of the Flower Moon or Oppenheimer. But Annette Bening turned in a worthy performance. But that doesn't mean I think Margot Robbie sucked. So where I had a little trouble was Gerwig, but you know, we had a call last week and we kind of reacted to the nominations, and it was refreshing to hear that somebody pointed out that it's not like somebody conspired to keep Gerwig out, because it's a voting body, and it's and they're going to vote who they feel is deserving. But if Gerwig has been shut out three times for films, and she is, I think of her as one of the greatest filmmakers, modern filmmakers currently. I would put Todd Haynes there as well. That's another story. And Carol is one of my favorites of the modern era. But that just shows that there have been reforms. There is more representation. That's great. Are they at an end point? And will they ever get there? Maybe not, or maybe not yet. So we'll see. But like you've put so eloquently in your book, the Oscars have never been perfect. And I loved that you went back and you even talked about The Dark Knight and some other. The Oscars have never been friendly to popular films. And frankly, The Dark Knight is what got it to 10. So if you look at the Best Director nominations, it's possible Barbie would have missed the Best Picture cut. So yeah, it's a something we could argue, and we do argue about. A lot of people really, really argue on the internet and kind of consumes this. But I'm glad to hear your takes on that, and we'll put the link to that article in the show notes. And also, we really wanted to explore, we haven't mentioned them yet, but you can see the people on video can see in Jill and my background, we have, we have Atticus Finch on one side, and
That's just sexy Gregory Peck.
Sexy Gregory, okay.
Probably, I'm guessing, on the beach era, maybe a little before that. But yeah, looking fine.
Trying to think of a way to combine sexy Gregory. Rexery? I don't know.
Rexery. But listen, it was a great transition here because, as you're talking about the Academy, barely gets it right. And so talk about how Gregory Peck tried to bring the Academy.
Almost saved the Oscars back in. Or would you say, Michael, is that fair? Would you say he saved the Oscars or reformed?
Well, the Oscars were certainly in crisis in the 60s. And Gregory Peck had a really important role in that. So one of the chapters in the book, and we haven't really said this, but the book does not cover every year. It's like 11 right. stories of different Oscar years right. that were turning points. And I looked for moments that told a larger story about how the culture was changing, how the industry was changing, American life was changing. Obviously the 60s, there was a lot of change.
Right. Yeah.
And of all people, Gregory Peck was the person at the center of the Academy during that time. He was the president of the Academy for, you know, much of the 60s. This was coming off of his win as Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird. So he was kind of seen as this, you know, patrician figure, this patriarch, this kind of liberal daddy, you know. and he certainly, his politics were very liberal at the time, but he was not, you know, he was no hippie. He's a square-jawed old movie star at the time. He's in his, you know, 50s or so. And then along come the late 60s, and of course, movies changed radically. And he could see that something was a little bit off, because many people in the Academy were people who had been at the height of their careers in the 30s. And right. then you had this new wave of American movies come along, stuff like The Graduate and Bonnie and Clyde and 2001 A Space Odyssey and Rosemary's Baby. And they were getting nominated, but they weren't winning. And the Academy was old in so many words. It was behind the times. And the Academy is a really big cruise ship to try to steer into a new direction. So he saw that it fell upon him to do something about it. And so the story I tell is about basically between the Oscars of 1969 and the Oscars of 1970, what changed. And one thing that was fascinating to me about it is in 1969, the winner was Best Picture was Oliver, which was rated G. Still the only G-rated movie to win Best Picture. And then a year later, the winner was Midnight Cowboy rated X.
Right.
So in 1 year, we went from G to X.
And of course, the rate. Thanks to Daddy.
Well, they changed that though. It became an R eventually.
Obviously, the rating system, you know, the ratings were completely new at that point.
Right.
They replaced the production code. But like, that's a change. And then in the meanwhile, what was going on during that year? Well, quite a lot. Like the Manson murders, for instance.
Right.
You know, it was a crazy year in America and in Hollywood. So early on, even before I started writing the book, I got a tip off from someone who is familiar with the Academy archives that if you looked in Gregory Peck's papers at the Academy Museum, you could find this incredible correspondence between him and the young Candace Bergen.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and found those letters and basically built this chapter around them because they were so interesting. Candace Bergen, of course, we think of now as, you know, Murphy Brown, or for even younger people, they think of her from, like, I don't know, Book Club or Legally Blonde, like the sort of grand dame. But in 1969, she was like a young, cool it girl, starlet. Mm-hmm. And she was also a Nepo baby. You know, her father was, of course,
lots of those in Oscar history.
It was Edgar Bergen, the ventriloquist, but she was kind of rebelling against that world and being this kind of like chic, hippie.
Can you imagine being a Nepo baby of a ventriloquist? I mean, come on.
Or like Albert Brooks. Nepo babies gave out the awards for many, many years. I think they might still give out the Globes. I'm not current on that.
Yeah.
Well, if you haven't read her memoir, Knock Wood, it's so fun. Her first memoir, it's all about sort of growing up with this quote unquote brother made of wood, Charlie McCarthy. And she from the start, she was just very dry and droll. You know, she has that great sense of humor. But anyway, she at the time was like 23 or something. And she was this it girl. And she was, you know, she watched the Academy Awards in 69 when Oliver won. And she realized that she didn't see anyone her age in the audience or on the stage. And she wrote Gregory Peck this amazing letter. Wait, maybe I can find it here in the book. It's so terrific because she is so, you know, here it is. I'll just say a little bit of what she said. Dear Mr. Peck, not being an Academy member, I'm most certainly out of place in writing you. I am a film lover and you seem to be the most receptive and constructive of all Academy presidents. Among the rising questions provoked by antiquated Academy rules is that of membership. Many or most members are anachronisms, clogging the works of an incredibly facile mechanism called motion pictures.
Logging.
I would be very grateful if I could help in any way to recruit newer, younger members. Perhaps one way is compiling a list of those whose creativity and energy the Academy never before solicited, etc. And then Gregory Peck wrote back immediately and said, yes, please do it. Mm-hmm. You know, go find us some young, hip people. And so Candace Bergen went out and got, you know, friends like, you know, Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda and Dustin Hoffman to join the Academy. And so it was a kind of this generation gap. Like they were literally speaking across the generation gap to each other. And I found that so fascinating.
I think it was so fascinating for me to read about Peck pushing against the grain of his contemporaries. I know you'd mentioned the average age of the Academy was extremely high, and then there had been people that were members and part of the voting body for decades who hadn't worked on films. And you know, you want to be inclusive, you want to hear a lot of voices, but the thing is, one thing that really struck me, speaking of like, you know, BBS and a lot of the American New Wave, is that they thought the Academy was so uncool that they didn't mm-hmm. even, many of them didn't even want to be members. And one thing, by the way, there's an excerpt in the New Yorker about that chapter, but I did read it, but it didn't seem it wasn't complete, I don't believe. There were a couple things I'd remember.
It was not the entire chapter. Like the entire chapter also talks about like Dennis Hopper making Easy Rider and John Schlesinger making Midnight Cowboy and a couple of other elements. But for that excerpt, I just took the part about Gregory Peck and Candace mm-hmm. Bergen. And, you know, so the other side of what was happening was that Peck was determined to update the membership. And mm-hmm. at first, his plan was to get rid of all of the PR people and the kind of marketing executive people, because he felt they didn't belong. And this was, he already knew this was going to be a sort of controversial move. And then what he ultimately did right after the 1970 Oscars was institute a new rule that anyone who hadn't worked in movies for 7 years was made a quote unquote associate member, which means they couldn't vote mm-hmm. for the Oscars. So in addition to bringing in, you know, the Dennis Hoppers, he was pushing out, you know, people who just were irrelevant, you know, who had kind of missed the 60s.
Right.
And, you know, another thing that's in his papers at the Academy Library are all the hate mail that he got from, you know, old timey people, like, you know, a producer of like an Abbott and Costello movie who was saying, well, I actually did this, this, and this, and sort of, you know, blaming him for, you know, some kind of heresy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that he sort of took meetings with people and some people reinstated, but it was a really bold move and one that he knew needed to happen. You know, I kind of imagined him as Atticus Finch in this moment, thinking like, it's not the popular stand, but it's the courageous thing to do. It's the right thing to do. Like, you have to stick to your guns. And he actually did push the Academy forward into the, you know, into the 70s.
What I love too is that while he's doing this, he's also righting some wrongs. So, 1970, I believe, is when Cary Grant received his honorary Oscar, and Grant had boycotted. I mean, he was no longer a member, and he had boycotted the awards because, for many reasons, but he was hacked off that he wasn't getting recognition rightfully. Pissed off about treatment of Ingrid Bergman, his friend, treatment of Charlie Chaplin. And, you know, Grant was very rarely political, but in those two instances with people he loved and regarded, he spoke out. And Gregory Peck smoothed that over, and Grant reinstated his membership and got that honorary award, which I think is wonderful and probably paved the way for when did Chaplin receive his honorary? Was it 74? But that also, pretty, you know, I would imagine paved the way time, for that as well. So anyways, I do like that he was pushing it forward, but also going, hey, we've done some really lousy things in the past. We need to make this right.
Gregory Peck had a sort of, you know, he was like the Secretary of State. Like, he had a sort of diplomat's kind of elegance and graciousness and ability to sort of charm people. And you can tell that, like, he was good at this job. That's why he was one of the most transformative Academy presidents. And he also had this sort of stature and you know, fame. You know, it was so interesting to see all the things that were swirling around him at the time. For instance, I talked to two of his sons who are still, you know, around. And one of them had been arrested on campus for what do you call it? Like, you know,
Civil disobedience.
Yeah. And another was in Vietnam, and it was, you know, Stephen was writing letters home from Vietnam, and Gregory Peck was like sending him Bronte novels to read in the barracks. You know, he was like this gentleman, this liberal giant, kind of the shadow version of Reagan at the time. And then they all lived through the Manson murders, and they had to put up, you know, guards in their house. And then, you know, one of the things that I loved about reading his correspondence is he'd be writing from, you know, his house in the south of France or something, complaining about the, you know, the butler. But there was clearly a lot happening. And meanwhile, he'd write to Margaret Herrick, who was the, you know, the executive director of the Academy, and the library is named after her. Mm-hmm. And you could just see in these little bits of everyday Academy business sort of what he had to deal with, like people writing in complaints about Barbara Streisand's see-through dress from 1969, the year of the tie. Right. you know, people who thought that the ceremony was too far out, as he said. But they also had a ratings issue. So they had to like appeal to the new America, like the new people mm-hmm. who were emerging in America, the right. baby boom generation, the people who right. are now rabid about movies, but not the ones that were winning awards like Oliver, you know?
Right.
And, you know, the position that he was in is that he like didn't belong in that new generation and he knew it. He was no right. hippie. He was a dad in his 60s, liberal dad in his 50s. And, in a sense, it was a kind of sacrificial move to sort of sure. push the Oscars closer to this new world because he didn't belong in it. And in fact, the movies right. he was making that year were all kind of bad.
Yeah. You know, his, yeah.
That's great self-awareness, yeah, really. Yeah.
That most of the stuff I think he was fighting for relevance in his roles, but he knew that they weren't great. Mm-hmm. Boys from Brazil is, I mean, it's terrible. It's just terrible. But you know, I was thinking about later, this and but, yeah. he's absolutely from that earlier generation, but can you think of a better person to do this? Because he realized the importance of this new generation and the impact that they were having on culture. And then he has this, you know, he's very anti-war and he has his son fighting in Vietnam and he's trying to support him even though he doesn't, you know. So I think he's kind of that perfect bridge between those two, even though he's like, I know I'm a relic.
Yes, and at the same time, Candace Bergen was the perfect mm-hmm. bridge because
exactly.
she was both a young exactly. person who was like right. hanging out with like the Beach Boys and, you know, Dennis
and Terry
Hopper.
Melcher.
Right,
Terry
right. Melcher. That's a different
she
story.
Living with Terry Melcher. She yeah. was living with Terry
Speaking
Melcher
of Manson.
At right. the Sharon Tate house before right. Sharon Tate lived there.
Yeah.
So she was very, yeah. very close That's to crazy. The Manson world. And yet she was, you know, the daughter of this famous entertainer and she'd grown up like knowing you know, all these famous people.
Yeah,
like,
she knew all the old timers.
Yeah, she grew mm-hmm. up around like Frank Sinatra, yeah. Cary Grant, like the old Hollywood world was her world. So I think both of them were in the perfect position to kind of reach out to each other across.
And what
the,
an odd pairing,
across
but it's
the generation,
so,
yeah.
But it's lovely, and I can just see. I mean, Gregory Peck had his flaws, but I do think he was a good man, and he respected the youths. And
he had a strong sense of mm-hmm. principle,
yes.
I think.
Yes.
Which is so Atticus yeah. Finch of him, you know?
He was a steward. He was a steward of the Academy, is what he was going for.
Yes, and he cared a lot about the integrity of the Academy. You know, he knew that it had to mm-hmm. survive and that it had to evolve in order to survive.
Right.
And when you get to the actual awards, the 1970 ceremony, and watch them, it is fascinating because you can see the tension between the old Hollywood
yeah.
and new kind of playing
Wait,
out.
Wait, that's the year that John Wayne won, right, for True Grit?
Yeah, so John Wayne, yeah. You know, between, like, John Wayne and Bob Hope were the kind of the old crusty conservatives. You know, Bob Hope was hosting, and I think I talked to, when I talked to Candace Bergen about it, but, you know, she was there that year, and one of the presenters, and she says, she was wearing this incredible, like, psychedelic poncho mm-hmm. thing, and she was like, Bob Hope was the enemy. He was them, you know?
Right.
And right, certainly right. John Wayne was similar. And then you had like Dennis Hopper, you know, nominated for Easy Rider, coming in like a Stetson hat and like right. barely showing up. And he was this wild man who, you know, had been in True Grit.
Bit of a maniac.
A maniac, a raving yeah. maniac.
A crazy person.
Yeah.
And John Voight, too, which is funny because he was yeah. in this film, but, you know, probably yeah. was a little closer in political ideology to John
changed,
Wayne.
He's changed a lot. He's the John yes. Wayne of he's, now. Yeah. But, you know, back then, I talked to people who knew him back then, and they said, like, he had this bleeding heart for, like, the poor and marginalized. And, mm-hmm. like, obviously, this is not the John Voight we're dealing
no.
with today. But, no. You know, one of my favorite parts of that ceremony, I'm going to find this in the book as well, is it closes with Bob Hope giving this closing speech that I you know, I quoted it in full almost in the book because I find it so interesting. He goes, he comes out at the end of the night and he goes, "Never again will Hollywood be accused of showing a lollipop world. Perhaps by showing the nitty gritty, by giving the world a glimpse of the element of violence and its destructive effect, it will help cool it. Whatever violence the screen has shown is not an example to follow, but to see in its full destructive power. The troubled, kooky characters that people the screens are not examples to emulate, but to learn from and try to understand and hopefully perhaps contrive help for." So, you know, in a way, he's like looking at this new film scene that includes like Easy Rider and Midnight Cowboy and saying, well, I guess these are examples of what we shouldn't be like morally, which is like totally misreading the moment. But you can see him trying to sort of reckon with the idea that this is not his Hollywood anymore. It's not the lollipop world.
And he certainly wasn't going to condone it.
And Michael, what's interesting about Peck is that he didn't act unilaterally. You know, of course, the Bergen, and by the way, the Bergen letter, at least part of it, is in your excerpt. And she even talks about the quality of her stationery, which I, you know, that bolsters the message that to Peck. But he also had, and I forget the names, but I remember in your book it was mentioned. I don't believe this was in the excerpt. That people like Billy Wilder and Preminger and I think Mankiewicz, but other you know, yeah, I don't want to use the word dinosaur because but relic is a better word. People that knew good filmmaking, and knew what wasn't good film and good filmmaking, I would wager that they would not put their, you know, they would prefer Midnight Cowboy than Oliver, but they also, you know, supported Peck, it sounds like, a few of the old auteurs, and that I think kind of was even not more impressive than what Peck did, but you know, again, self-aware that hey, their heyday has passed, they made their great movies, you know, some of the best movies of all time, but they knew, and they also had watched foreign movies, and they had seen the, you know, the genesis from you know, the classic Hollywood to this new American cinema. And, you know, 8.5 was nominated for in the 60s where, you know, so I thought that was an interesting too, is that Peck, while he made enemies, he certainly had allies, and some of those allies came from, you know, his generation. So I was glad that you included that.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why I told this story in the first place was that it has some obvious resonance with what's been happening over the past 10 years at the Oscars. This whole book kind of originated when I was writing a New Yorker piece about the aftermath of Oscars So White and how the Academy was trying to diversify its membership then. And I went out to LA and I talked to Cheryl Boone Isaacs, who was the Academy president at the time, the Academy's first Black president. And she was in the position where, you know, there was this uproar over Oscar So White and she had to figure out what to do about it. And she, you know, they had an emergency meeting. They put this whole initiative through to bring in more diverse members of all kinds. And it was a really important kind of structural change for the Academy, one that made her many enemies personally, as well as many supporters. But even as that was happening, she was sending letters to the membership saying, you know, look at what Gregory Peck did in 1970 as a kind of precedent for what she was doing. And it was a similar thing in the sense that they were bringing in a lot of new people, but they were also taking a small number of people and making them, quote unquote, emeritus members who couldn't vote in the Oscars, which was very similar to Peck's associate members. Both Cheryl Boone Isaacs and Gregory Peck got a lot of hate mail. But I think they both came along in periods when culture was changing radically and Hollywood had to keep up and the Academy had to keep up with that. And if Hollywood moves slow, which it does, then the Academy in a way moves even slower, except for these moments like these, like, you know, I think of Moonlight winning is a lot like Midnight Cowboy winning. You know, it was right. like, oh my God, that one.
Great parallel. Yeah.
It changes your perception of what a best picture looks like, of who it represents, of the world that it's showing you. And, you know, those moments are so exciting because you can tell that they like times are changing. Like, this is new. This is new and exciting and unexpected. And I think of those 2 years as kind of as connected.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, when I read that chapter on Peck, and you know, I'm not going to rank the chapters of your book, but that one really spoke to me because I knew Peck more as an actor, and maybe we can get into that a little bit, but I immediately saw the parallels. I was like, this is basically the same thing as Oscar So White. So it was great to kind of like make that connection, or that you made that connection. And actually, so there is a precedent for somebody making sweeping reforms to change how we rate art,
the fact weird. That Moonlight won and Midnight Cowboy won, it is so great, but then it is also what irritates me so much about the Oscars, because they get it wrong like 90% of the time. Mm-hmm. But there are these moments where they've had, you know, there's pressure, or they've had this brief moment of enlightenment where they go, well, we're actually gonna, you know, give the movie that really deserves this. And unfortunately, it's like they can't hold on to that for very long, and they go back to their
sometimes
crowd pleasing Argo, you know, and you know, mm-hmm. they love movies about Hollywood, so that's always Fresh. Gonna happen, you know.
Yeah.
So but it does give me hope that maybe we'll get another, you know, another Moonlight. But hopefully it won't take 40 years for that to happen.
Well, I mean,
again.
I thought Parasite was a really exciting
That was
win.
Great. That was great. And it also outs all the like horrid racists too, because they all come out and talk, you know, about how did that win Best Picture? It's a foreign film. God forbid.
Yeah, and it came after the Academy had brought mm-hmm. in a lot more international members. So, and now you see movies like All Quiet on the Western Front and Anatomy of a Fall, and much more international movies, and breaking into the Best Picture race.
So maybe it'll stay. Maybe we can maintain this stretch a little bit longer.
I mean, Jill, what I would say, because I can sense your frustration about the Oscars, and I appreciate it, is. I feel like if you look to the Oscars as a barometer of what the actual, you know, best movies were or best performances, mm-hmm. and it's as some kind of barometer, they are always failing. They're never going to be right.
Right.
How I look at the Oscars are mm-hmm. a kind of mirror of the movie industry. It's a sort of it's a way of seeing how Hollywood sees itself, or how it wants to see itself. Yeah. And if you sort of look at it through that lens, they have a lot to tell us about the choices that people are making. That's why with Barbie, it's like, I have my own like personal feelings about what's good about Barbie, what's not, what mm-hmm. I, you know, what's not as good about Barbie. But the fact is, Barbie is the biggest movie of the year. And for it to have this kind of like, mm-hmm. this cognitive dissonance within the Academy, it's like, what is that telling you about the people who make up the Academy?
Right.
And it's almost like mm-hmm. whether it deserves it all, it's like every person can decide that for themselves.
Sure.
But the Academy is revealing sort of like what the people in Hollywood want to say about where movies are going, where the industry is headed. And so the stuff that comes out of their collective minds, their collective voting, is super fascinating.
Good point.
Yeah, Barbie's great, but it's no Carol, it's no Midnight Cowboy, it's no Citizen Kane, you know, but...
No, and I do need to start viewing this more as this is what Hollywood thinks of itself, or how, because I can list for the next, you know, 3 weeks all the people that never won an Oscar. We know it's not an arbiter of what is good cinema, good acting. I mean, for Christ's sake, Myrna Loy never won an Oscar. She was never nominated for an Oscar. Edward G. Robinson was never nominated for an Oscar. That's insane to me.
And even more recently, Peter O'Toole, he got the honorary. And he's like, I'm still in the game. Of course, he did not get that opportunity, but.
But yeah, this at the same time, you know, people say that constantly about Annette Bening, and that's probably one of the reasons right. why she was nominated over Margot Robbie.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So
that's
even
right.
that feeling of like, oh, how does this person not have an Oscar in their huge career? It means they get nominated for something and then knock someone else out, which causes some other uproar.
Right.
Yeah. But it's fun. It's a great water cooler talk. And that's why, especially this last week, I was actually surprised by how big this conversation was. Like, in fact, I kind of wanted it to end.
Well, this
like,
is
all right, we got
this
it.
Time of year is the one time where the normal people and us weirdos, like we converge to discuss.
Well, yes. And also think about how many people saw Barbie, you know, there's
That's
just
right.
way more people now who are invested in that
movie
than are invested in, like, you know, Nomadland.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
And if they really wanted to, you know, if they wanted the Oscars to be a PR machine, they would have nominated Taylor Swift in like every category. So, you know, the NFL is doing that. So speaking of which, this is great. I do want to ask Jill. So, you know, you had played Peck, or you had, written about Peck and portrayed him as the everyman father, the liberal father, as you mentioned earlier. And that was kind of my perception just based on seeing films like, you know, The Yearling or Big Country. And Jill and I were talking earlier, and that's where the sexy Greggy.
Sexy Greggy.
I'm going with that. Sexy Greggy. Greggy. And I actually, what's weird is, you know, everybody was young once, but I had trouble reconciling that because I thought he was just
born with those Oliver Peoples glasses.
I just thought he's dad. He's the dad everybody wants, but no, apparently he's something else other people want.
So yeah, I was enlightening Aaron to the early part of the non-Yearling or the non-Keys the Kingdom, which, I mean, he was the original sexy priest, hot priest.
Yeah.
But I was like, no. There's a whole era of sexy Gregory Peck, believe it or not. You know, I think about Duel in the Sun, which is one of my great guilty pleasures. Apologies for Jennifer Jones portraying a Indigenous woman, but who is wanton in character and throwing herself after Gregory Peck, who is just so smoldering. He's vile. He's a vile human. He's a rapist. He's a racist. He's everything that I detest, and yet he is smoldering in this film, all the way up to the very end when he's yelling out, "I'm dying, Pearl," and he's clutching his gut. So yeah, I was telling Aaron about the really terrible movie, The Great Sinner. He's still fantastic in it, and there's just this really steamy scene between him and Ava Gardner. So we just thought we would use this opportunity to just call attention to sexy Peck, sexy Greggy.
Well, yeah, we also haven't mentioned possibly his second most famous role, which is in Roman Holiday.
Yes.
You know, he's in one of the romances
he's so fine. Oh.
Yeah, and like absolutely charming and hunky. And you know, by the way, a movie that was written by Dalton Trumbo to bring it back to the Blacklist. Who then was unable to accept his award. But yeah, I mean, certainly he was kind of the I think he was a rower, like a college rower.
He was,
you know, he was like built and from what I remember, he sort of arrived in Hollywood like during the war, and like a lot of leading men were they were thin on men and they needed like a hunky guy. And
Dennis Morgan had a career. They were very, cut.
And that's why it took so long for Bogey to have a career.
No, this is why you like, had Van Jones and Dennis Morgan that were like major stars, as they were probably like, George Raft. No, they're not at this point. George Raft was so over by the 40s.
Well, I mean, but yeah, I
no,
just mean,
he, no, yeah, he yeah, was one but... of the few that had the charisma and the charm and the looks and everything, and he wasn't shipped off. So, but they didn't know what to do with him either. Those first few roles, mm-hmm. they were definitely, it was some very confusing casting. But then also he gets what, 3 nominations in a row?
Yeah, right away.
I mean, bam, bam, bam. Mm-hmm. So Yearling, He's the Kingdom, and then Gentleman's Agreement, which talk about a film that has is important,
right.
but definitely has not held up well. But yeah, so he was getting that recognition early, but it was still kind of a hodgepodge casting for him in the 40s. And I would say probably, see what, Roman Holiday was 1950. I would say it really, that was... to me, maybe
it's 53.
And I'm trying to think what he did before then, but it was very confusing casting for him, I think, up to that point. Kind of all over the place. I still love him. I still love him in all of that, but they just didn't quite know what to do with him.
I called him America's Dad, and then you showed me that GIF, and I think the joke I made was, okay, that was America's Dad at the time of conception.
But they really, it was kind of like a confused, and I think he was in a film, it might have been his
we'll
second
have to share
film,
that again. Yeah.
Days of Glory, which was like, I don't know if you've seen that film, Michael, but
no.
It's a Jacques Tournier, and it's,
oh wow,
it's,
yeah.
Not a great film, but again, they just didn't really know what to do with him. They didn't know if they should cast him as this kind of stalwart, good man and dad person, or if he should just be just smoking up the screen. So they kind of flipped, they went back and forth. It was like, okay, you're going to play a priest now. And then over here, right. You're going to do, you know. So
well,
was...
I think that it probably took that long because ultimately the type that he was best at was kind of enlightened authority figure.
Absolutely.
And that is what I think really mm-hmm. clicked with To Kill a Mockingbird. But then as, you know, time went on, that's sort of who he played. He was like, mm-hmm. you know, the sheriff or the, you know, the guy, like the guy back at,
right.
at NASA, like, you know, he... Exactly.
The authority
he was
figure.
The man running the show.
Yes.
Which is kind of what he was at the Academy at the time.
That's right. It's funny you say that, but he made a film called, oh, I cannot believe, I have watched a lot of his movies, but he made one called Night People for Fox. That's, you know, like, he's some military guy. I don't know. He was always kind of that revered authority figure. That might have a little dark, you know, Man in the Gray Flannel Suit. That's another one where he's like,
oh, you know, yeah, that's one of my wife's dad's favorite films ever. So we watched
that.
He
is
was
like,
so
he
happy,
is,
but
he's respected and he's the family man and very above board. And then you find out he had a lover during the mm-hmm. war. So that's kind of like the dark, and he has a son from that, you know. So he could kind of dabble in that a little bit, which also makes The Omen so crazy. The fact that, you know, he's in that, and he's perfect for it.
Yeah, I mean, that's when the new Hollywood finally figured out what to do with him.
What to do with him, exactly.
But I'm trying to find this other quote from this chapter because... you know, the stuff that he was doing in 1969, 1970 was so, like, weird. Like, you
he
know,
was
it was
in some really weird,
like, Maroon.
Yeah.
That was the NASA movie. And then he was in this movie, I Walked the Line, with Tuesday Weld.
Yes.
He plays like a sheriff
who
has a torrid affair with this younger woman. And he doesn't, like, you know, he's not the right person for someone who has who sort of loses control to carnality. But
mm-hmm. no.
There was a, oh, here it is. At the beginning of 1970, Vincent Canby wrote this really vicious critique of the movies that he'd been making. He wrote that the end of the 60s had brought, quote, no less than 4 Gregory Peck performances that can only be described as ambassadorial. And it said he mentioned a bunch of movies he'd been in, like The Stalking Moon and The Chairman and Maroon, and said that he looked as if he were on some high-level mission on behalf of clean resonant speech.
What's interesting is with those roles is that Finch and Mockingbird was really in recent memory. I mean, if you think about, like, I don't know how long, what year Carol was, but, like, you know, when Midnight Cowboy won, it was just
think about what happened in those 7 years.
This is only
Oscar.
Right,
but see, that's
so
an eternity.
Different.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
That's right.
That's an eternity.
Hero, yeah, the Vietnam, liberal hero dad of 1963 is now the sort of crusty old authority figure of 1970.
Yeah,
yes. Kids did not want that.
No. And if you look at what, there's some attempts mm-hmm. here. Like, he was in Mirage and Arabesque, which were two kind of like groovy, know, spy movies. And then, I mean, it's the filmography falls off. I mean, his work falls off sharply after mm-hmm. To Kill a Mockingbird. And I think it is reflective of the kind of roles he was playing and what is going on at that time.
I have some line in the book where I did the math and realized, like, if you were 12 and watched To Kill a Mockingbird in mm-hmm. you know, 63 and, like, saw him as, like, mm-hmm. this heroic dad, by 1970 you were burning your draft card, you know.
That's right Yeah.
That's
no,
great,
it's just
great. Yeah,
and then
yeah.
Well,
time flies
7 years, and especially back then, 7 years was an eternity in Hollywood. They didn't, well, pre this time, if you're talking about pre-television, they did not make these, they were not thinking about these movies having any lasting impact. It was just like cranking them out. And mm-hmm. certainly 7 years, my God, some of these actors were making, you know, by that point had 50 credits to their name. So there was no... that's an eternity. And then you pair it up with this decade of huge change, social and political change. Yeah. That might as well mm-hmm. have been 40 years prior. It's insane. Even mm-hmm. though that's a film would have been very progressive and edgy for the time. But he, you know, he just would have been out of, he wasn't cool. He wasn't cool at all.
I think we should have a journey for Peck, and we can have the sexy Greggy, and then we could have, like, your dad's friend as the second part.
Let me tell you that I have gone through many Gregory Peck phases in my life, and I always, you know, I will pick, like, a section mm-hmm. of his career and go through these films and everything, and I always called it Peckathon, but then I had people tell me that may be taken the wrong way. So, but maybe we need to do Peckathon 3.0. But no. Yeah, I exactly know. But no, this has been fascinating. Yeah. And I'm so glad that you mm-hmm. you picked that era to go through, because it really and there were some things that, so I've actually peered very briefly into his papers at the Herrick, but I was looking at another era, because I'm actually, I've been saying this for 10 years, but I'm writing a book on Frederick March, and so and his wife Florence Eldridge, and so you know, I every now and then we'll dabble in other actors' papers, so I have seen some of those things that you mentioned earlier, which were fascinating, and I had to pretend like they were related to my research, but I couldn't help myself. So I'm so glad that, because I've always, you know, associated his reign with giving people their due. So, and that's usually what's brought up, is, oh, he got Carrie his mm-hmm. honorary, but really what he was doing was much more than that. And the Candace Bergen connection is absolutely fascinating. So thank you so much for your work on that. And
Yeah, and cheers to them too. I mean, really, I you highlighted it so eloquently in your book and on this episode. But Yeah, Gregory Peck and Candace Bergen.
That's like Bergen, dream
Bergen.
team.
What a superhero duo. But they did change the Oscars for the better. I think the 70s Oscars, and you could go into this in your book, like you said, not every year, but I think that they did capture modern America, that new American Hollywood at the time. And I would love to talk about this forever, but it would be a disservice to not ask you about, speaking of Oscars, there's this little known actress named Meryl Streep that might have a couple, maybe a few more noms, but you wrote a book about her, which I'm looking forward to. That's probably going to be one of my next books. Maybe we should do a Streep journey too.
I went on a Streep
she's
journey.
She's had a few.
For sure.
But, I bet you did. So Streep is a massive topic. So a book is a good avenue to explore that. But can I just ask, what got you onto Streep, and maybe, some of
oh my
your
gosh,
favorites
what
of
got me
hers,
into her?
or
I
somebody
mean,
that she's from.
there was a certain point when I was actually like 10 years ago or so, a little 12 years ago, I would like memorize all of her acceptance speeches and I could like perform them at
I
parties.
Love this.
Like
Is
if
amazing.
You said, do, Meryl Streep's Emmy speech for Angels in America, I could. And, that's the one where she says, there are some days I myself think I'm overrated. But not today. And then it kind of climaxed with her Oscar speech for The Iron Lady, where she said, oh, when they called my name, it was like I could hear half of America going, oh, come on, why? Her again. But whatever. And so I ended up naming the book Her Again.
Love it.
And the question was, for me, like how did she become this, Mount Olympus of actors? Who was she before that moment? Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of an origin story that looks at her life in the 70s when she was in her 20s and her time at Yale School of Drama and her romance with John Cazale and making Kramer versus Kramer and sort of battling with Dustin Hoffman and second wave feminism. Like, it's sort of her journey through life up to her first Academy Award and her kind of emergence as a movie star. And you asked my favorites. It's sort of a tie between Kramer versus Kramer and The Devil Wears Prada.
Oh.
And they seem very different, but I would say that they have something in common, which is each of them are movies where she played the person who's supposed to be the villain.
That's right.
And she sort of turns that character into the secret hero.
That's great.
Yeah, I could see that. I'm going French Lieutenant's Woman, I think. Or Defending Your Life. Yeah, I love Albert Brooks. Jill, do you have one? A Streep?
Oh, I would say Kramer versus
Kramer.
Kramer
versus Kramer
is
too.
Where I'm like, I'm so conflicted.
I think French Lieutenant's Woman was a little more artsy than people
well,
thought.
I
Carol
just,
Wright's,
as a mom, I don't know, like I understand her. But also am angry with her. So and she's so fascinating in that role. It's probably my favorite. Reminds me, I don't know if you've seen the movie The Money Pit. It's a
of
terrible
course.
movie,
Yeah, Tom Hanks.
But
yeah.
I love it. And
wasn't Shelley Long in that too?
Yeah, Shelley Long, which bless her with leaving Cheers for that ill-fated movie career. But I bring this up because in the film, Tom Hanks is like he manages music groups, music acts, and one of his bands is kind of like a, hair band, Twisted Sister type, where they're kind of gender bending. And I can't remember the name of the band, but then they want to change their name to Meryl Streep. And he's like their lawyer or whatever, and he's like, you can't do that because she's gonna sue us. And the guys, he's got like, it's 5 o'clock shadow and he's got a cigar, but he's wearing like a dress and a wig, and he just says, yeah, well, we're gonna name ourselves Meryl Streep. I just think that's fascinating. So
well, I can't wait to read your book. I'm going to try to read it through Oscar season because, she's so synonymous with it. And I want to go to your parties where people ask you to do impressions. You're invited to ours anytime, Michael. Just memorize some.
Yeah, let's have a party and have you come down and do all the speeches. That would be fantastic.
I can't guarantee that I still remember them all, but I did, there was definitely a moment when in my like late 20s when I was it was like my party trick.
That's a great party trick. So
that's fantastic. Well, this was fantastic, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us because we know you're super busy.
Michael, where can people, so obviously people can find the books wherever people find books,
you have a website? Hurrigan and Oscar Wars. I've got a website if you want to go to it. It's michael-dolman.com. I don't know, not much on it. I'd also tell people I write for The New Yorker. So you can catch up with my work there, including my coverage of Oscar season. I'll be going this year and doing my dispatch about my night, my Oscar night diary.
So do you go to any of the after parties?
Yeah, I go to the Governor's Ball. I go to Vanity Fair. I went one time to the Elton John party.
Oh, fun.
It's a long night.
All right, I'm booking my flight to.
That's awesome.
I actually used to live right above the Emmys in North Hollywood, so I was kind of immersed in that. But I did not go to any Oscar parties. I was a tech bro. I was not cool enough.
Well, that sounds fantastic. Yeah.
But no, it's been great. Oh, any social media that you could follow?
Well, yes. I mean, I'm on Twitter, but I'm not, or X or whatever the hell. I'm not using it that much at the moment, but I'm at MJ Shulman. Mm. I'm on other things like Instagram and Threads under just my name, Michael Shulman. I don't know.
All right. We understand Twitter. I had a very nice account and I finally nuked my Twitter account. I just couldn't.
Yeah. The world is in social media limbo at the moment. So we'll see. Maybe your next book could be the social media wars, or maybe not.
I mean, if you want to see my vacation pictures, they're on Instagram, but you know, what can I tell you?
Hey, come over to Blue Sky. Cool. It's very nice.
Oh, I have an account on that. I just don't, it's like, I'm on like five things now and I don't know
to follow.
Yeah, no, we're definitely in the wild. Well, we're kind of in the wild west of new social media right now. So we'll see what happens. But Blue Sky is very, it's nice. I check in like once or twice a week. And I think what I've realized too with the demise of Twitter is that I was on there way too much. And now I'm not really online very much. And I feel like healthier, like just generally healthier and happier. So I'm kind of like,
I think a good way to end this is to say, I think social media right now needs a Gregory Peck for our times. So I'll just leave it there.
We do. I know for real. Who is today's Gregory Peck? Everyone says, well, Tom Hanks is today's Jimmy Stewart or whatever. So who is today's Gregory Peck?
That's a really interesting question to end on. Who is today's Gregory Peck? No, you wouldn't cast him as like authoritative dad, like, you know, moral arbiter. Who plays like the moral arbiter when they show up? And you're like,
I'm going to think of it later.
He's going to do what's
probably
right.
At 2 a.m.
I don't know.
Maybe Jack, but he's not acting.
This is going to be something it's going to keep.
No, because he was always like a little
even
wily
when he
wicked.
Aged. Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of people, we've lost a lot of people too. So we're going to ruminate.
This is hard. This is
so members,
very
let's
hard.
Go on the forums and talk about who is the new Peck.
So, Michael, when you think of this at 3
like
o'clock
who would
in
play
the morning.
Who do you cast as Atticus Finch right now? I don't know. Like maybe Jeff Bridges? He sort of
So Jeff Bridges, I could see Jeff Bridges, and we see Jeff Daniels.
Like
that
the
on
newsroom.
Broadway.
That's a very, but then that's because he's in these sort of like, you know, Aaron Sorkin-y.
Right. Like, and I just... But maybe Jeff Daniels. I could see that. But he's a little. He's got that hippie streak in him, though, that Peck didn't have.
Oh, you mean Jeff Bridges?
Jeff Bridges, yeah. He's got. Yeah. I mean, you know, when you know that, like, all the costumes for the dude, you know, were hit, like out of his, you know, out of his closet.
Right.
That's very like he owns jelly shoes. So I don't see
Gregory
Peck wearing
jellies. He's definitely not a square.
No, he's not a square.
He's like a
But maybe the closest mm-hmm. thing to where you would see him in that role and you go, yeah, I can buy it.
Yeah, if you have like a 1970 barometer where you have Dennis Hopper on one side and Gregory Hepp on the Gregory Peck on the other, and maybe Bridges would be like, you know, a quarter of the way to Hopper, but
I think we're onto something. That may be the closest.
I'm not satisfied
with that answer. I feel like I feel like we're missing someone.
Well, and Peck, I think that speaks to Peck.
Who's the good daddy right now?
He had quite the presence, and even if he intended to, you know, make that his brand, what, you know, or that his persona, you know, mission accomplished. You know, it's like I said, it's hard for me to unsee Atticus Finch. So
I had a thought and I lost it. No, I'm gonna think about it. There, I had like a Kevin Costner went like this and then zoomed right back out. It was like a flash. No. Harrison Ford. What about a Harrison Ford?
He's he doesn't prickly. Have the acting he's prickly. Chops. Have though. You met him, Michael?
He's 80. He's 80.
But there was just a Raiders movie.
We're talking about dad, not granddads.
Look, I'm just this is what happens when you I've got
how about Chad Lowe
juices.
Speaking of
Chad Lowe, Jesus,
that's another chapter that's fascinating of Michael's book.
Well, kind of,
that's a shit show, like literally.
Steve Carell, kind of, but he's too comic.
A little okay.
Matthew McConaughey, a little bit.
Yeah, I could see Matt McConaughey. All right. He doesn't have the father. I'll have to think
Denzel?
About that.
Denzel has a lot of moral authority when he shows up.
Yeah.
Could be him.
They're getting old. We have to find somebody like that was in their prime in like the 80s or early 90s, and that's who we get.
Sorry to inform you.
Okay, I'm going to throw one out. Now he's dead. But what about Bill Paxton? How do we feel about that?
Oh, that he would be great. He would be great.
Maybe
it's unfortunate that we couldn't have some older Paxton roles.
Yeah, I can see that.
Oh,
I think the closest we have now
after he went on did that America Ferrera thing.
Like he's someone who shows up, and even if he's playing a sort of scoundrel,
he's
you know,
prickly.
He's
prickly.
He's
have you met him,
fundamentally good. There's something about him that's fun. Like he's good, and he's also like incredibly handsome.
There was a Raiders movie,
but he's like your dad.
That's right. He checks all the boxes. Yeah, no, it's that. Why am I attracted to you?
How about Chad Lowe?
Because your dad.
That's another chapter that's fascinating. And he began his career with like Glory, but then he did like Devil in a Blue Dress and some edgier roles. That's a good one. Yeah.
I think you're good. I think we've settled.
Denzel it is. Great talking to you, Michael.
Glad we solved that one. It's good talking to you guys.
We will watch your blog on Oscar. We're probably going to do a live chat, so maybe we'll see what you have to say about the ceremony.